Shoes.
Recorded live.
Okay, this is Rick. So we've got one other person on the call right now, and more will be joining us. Are you, whoever's on here, do you have a microphone, or are you just on chat today? That means you are on chat. So let's hang on just a minute. We're a little bit early and it's not quite time to start yet. And we'll see what comes up here in a minute. Okay, so, good. Thank you for chatting back with me. I appreciate that. You can check on the microphone. Good. All right, so let's look at the first question we have today. Let me pull that back up here. Which is, Rick, you mentioned a few ago, there was a tool in the works which would allow us to monitor our mate's whereabouts through the use of cell phone. Could you please elaborate as to how this will work, and more importantly, when do you think it'll be available and through what avenues? You know, it's interesting what you're talking about. There actually is a way for a couple to stay in touch via their cell phones. In all cell phones, there's the ability to have GPS tracking. Now, both parties have to agree ultimately to have that turned on. And if they're willing to do that, certainly you can, follow and see where each other's are. Where, well, I can't even talk this morning. Where the other person is at any given time. The reality of the GPS on cell phones is that they are not always 100% accurate, and I have had times where it's created a bit of a problem simply because the GPS showed them to be several blocks away from where they actually were. So it's not 100% accurate, and obviously, when you end up in a situation where the phone is saying that there's some other place than they actually are, then that makes it difficult. However, that feature is available, as best I know, on any current cell phone here in the United States, and it can be tracked by computer. All you have to do is log in to the account, and you can see where the phone is. I believe what you're referring to was a mention I made for an application that we're currently, an iPhone application or a mobile application, trying to create. And it will not be ready this year. It'll be ready probably sometime next year. And what it will do actually is more than just going to the computer where you have to log in and see where the other person is, it actually will show you on a screen on the iPhone or whichever mobile app you're using as to where they're located. Not in a sense of spying, because the purpose for me and even in developing this really is not to promote spying or paranoia. But I think at times, I call it kind of blessed assurance, it's nice to know where your mate is and that everything is okay. And so, you know, we're hoping that providing that type of service will actually grant some people some peace and some assurance that they can be okay. Hope that answers that question. Here's another one. After I unloaded years of guilt and shame, I felt pretty good. The big secret was out. this big secret is out, and acting out was nearly 2 years behind me. Confidence and self-esteem feelings that were foreign are now here. But I still do battle the guilt and shame, and it comes when I pause to look at what I did to my wife and how she's paying the price for my shortcomings. Will this ever go away? Or maybe I don't want it to. Use it as a reminder that I don't ever want this to happen again. Well, the problem with guilt and shame as motivators is that ultimately they can create relapse. And the last thing you want to do is create a situation where relapse might occur, because as long as you're using guilt and shame as a motivator, what will happen, you'll be highly motivated unless the guilt and shame are gone, at which point you lose that motivation. So I recommend that with guilt and shame, that you hopefully, as good recovery goes, you begin to integrate and accept what you've done and accept who you are, and then ultimately, you know, help your mate heal to the best as possible. But those feelings, I think, do fade and do go away as the loss is transformed. I really do believe over time, the vast majority of couples that I see, they don't live with this incredible burden of what happened and the pain. The pain passes, and ultimately the benefit of what you begin to experience so far exceeds maybe the pain that it is. It's not like the means justifies the end, but you're so grateful for the incredible marriage and the incredible connection you have that, you know, that pain, it does fade. And really, in its place, it leaves no regret. I mean, I think that if I am in the right type of recovery, there is no regret in the long run. There's just a gratefulness that I was able to get out of the living hell that I've been in, and also a gratefulness for my mate, because, you know, she's going to be really, or he's going to be really excited to know that they got out of that awful pain. So the pain does go away, in answer to your question. And hopefully as you begin to have that loss transformed, you're going to sit there and find something that you've never experienced. And that would be, you know, our ultimate goal. Okay, here's the next question. We're short on questions today, so this should be really interesting. If y'all, those of you online, if you can do me a favor, if you've got any particular questions, and type them into the chat box, that would be good. Shattering. Rick, each of us who's experienced betrayal has said that he or she has felt shattered. Can you explain exactly what this shattering is, since it seems to be such an universal experience in this situation? Okay, shattering. The problem, and I just wrote this in an email earlier. I think it was the email that went out to the main newsletter list today. Our problem as human beings is that we all have to have primary attachments. All of us actually have primary attachments. As I say, if you're in the 911 group, we cover this. You know, the worst punishment you can actually give a human being is solitary confinement, because ultimately, if we are cut off from human connection, we will eventually go insane and die. And we are incapable of living on our own. And in the email I wrote, I think I explained that when I was a kid, we did this stupid stunt where we decided to go cliff diving in the middle of the night. And I was the one who got to discover that you can't see where you're going in the dark underwater, and almost drowned. Thankfully, someone turned on a flashlight, and I was able to find my way back to the surface. But what happens, there's a primal panic that happened for me when I was in that water, because I couldn't breathe, and I really didn't know how to find my way back out. in a very similar way, whenever a relationship, our primary bond with our significant other is broken, we experience that same primal panic. All of those needs for attachment are actually, you know, broken at that moment. And we go a bit insane. And that's why I think people describe it as shattered. It is very unnerving and very painful whenever those relationship bonds are broken. Because that other person serves basically as a point of security for us. And we really don't know, you know, what to do at that point. Because a lot of times we've kind of broken or left other bonds to really connect with our mate. You know, in the old Jewish tradition, it said, you know, a man shall leave his father and mother and be united with his wife, and the two shall become one. That in the long run, we've terminated other relationships and more or less put our eggs in this basket, making agreements with each other that we're going to be there for them, that we're going to care for them, that we're going to love them, that they really matter to us, and vice versa. You know, we understand that they're going to be there for us and that we matter to them. And that attachment is incredibly important. Then when broken, we go into that panic, and that's the shattering piece. It's very much like being deprived of air. We panic. We don't even know what to do. We're desperate to be able to breathe again, to have that connection, to be reattached. And yet at the same time, it doesn't feel that it's safe to make that reattachment. So it really creates quite a dilemma for us as we move into those relationships.
Rick?
Okay.
Rick?
Yes, ma'am.
This is Wendy.
Hey, Wendy.
I have a little extra question to that. Why is it so different, you know, the experience of that so different from the, you know, losing somebody that dies? Because I've had people I've been extremely close to who have died, and, you know, it isn't that same attack on your, you know, total being. It's, you know, you grieve and it's very painful, but it's not that same shattering experience.
Right. And that's because we hopefully are able to accept death. We see that as a natural part of life. That is, we can frame that as unfortunate, horrible, awful, painful. On the other hand, death is not something necessarily the other person controls. Now, I will tell you that sometimes with suicide, people sometimes get that same sort of shattering, but that's almost, again, more like a betrayal than when it's just a relationship where someone dies. If someone dies, we know what to do with that. We grieve it. But for someone to still be alive and to still be able to see them and to still be deprived of them, I think, Wendy, that's why it's very different at that point and why it's so disturbing to us.
Okay.
You know, like, I mean, I really do believe that death is much easier to deal with than a betrayal.
Well, I guess there's the choice factor involved there that makes it difficult to, you know.
Right. I don't get to choose whether or not I have a stroke or a heart attack, right? And so
right.
Somebody might be able to excuse me for dying. They may not be happy about it. But
not blame it on you anyway.
Right. But there's something really personal when someone, because the act of, you know, a sexual addiction or the act of, you know, an affair, basically they're kind of saying to you at that point, it, just by their actions in the moment, not their actions afterwards, but in the moment, that there's something else that's going to make me happier than you, something else that does a better job of satisfying me than you. At least that's how we interpret that. And so it feels a lot more personal, I think, than death. I mean, death is something that happened to them. This is something that happens to us.
Okay, Rick, I also, the next two are from me. They're postings that have been on the forum, and they're connected. I just couldn't get them both in on the same thing.
Okay. Yeah, I was just looking at that in just a second. This one here, Can't Stop. Yeah, this is a real interesting one. Recently on the forums, and this is true, an unfaithful spouse has been posting about not being able to give up his affair partner. I feel I'm addicted to my affair woman. It's like I'm incapable or unable to stop. I have such a good time with her. I feel so safe, and I can be myself with no reservations, yet I know I'm completely doing this wrong. Could you please address this for him? Anytime I talk to somebody who is in what I call limerence, and I think we've talked about limerence before, and I would, I think the description of being completely addicted to an affair partner is a great description, simply because the other person, there is such a profound chemical reaction that happens when you're with that person in the affair. In fact, if you read Dorothy Tenov's book, Love and Limerence, Helen Fisher has some good stuff on this also, a sociologist. There are such profound chemical reactions that occur when we're in that romantic relationship or that infatuation stage. And one of the things that it's like I'm unable to stop. I have such a good time with her. I feel so safe and can be myself with no reservations. Now, the reason that someone in that type of relationship feels so safe and feels they can be themselves with no reservations is because in a limerent relationship or an addicted relationship, since you want what you don't have, there's such a high that comes, and there's motivations for being in that relationship. There really is an unconditional, even a crazy acceptance that occurs in those types of relationships. I've talked about this before, but there's a process called crystallization, where because the feelings generated by the interactions, and they're counterfeit feelings. I mean, they're endorphins, they're norepinephrine, their adrenaline, there's all kinds of things being released within you as this mechanism is triggered. The feelings are so intense, and we crave the feelings, that feeling so much, that we lose the ability to weight any negatives in the relationship. In fact, all the negatives are basically written off. It's not that someone in this sort of relationship can't see the negative. It's just the negative doesn't make any difference. In the last EMS, not this weekend, but the past weekend, this past, but the one before, there were several people in limerent relationships, and they'd never really talked before about their affair partners. And what's amazing is, you know, they would begin to talk. I mean, one of them was talking about how her affair partner, and she was from a really nice family, her affair partner was an alcoholic who lived in a trailer park, who actually, you know, had a fairly sordid background. Now, and this was, I mean, this is a woman you would never dream would be with someone like that. But the feelings were so intense, it really didn't make any difference. I mean, she could see it, but she couldn't care about it because the relationship had made her feel so good. There was just no waiting to the negative. I had another person in a limerent relationship, and I'm sorry I'm using she's, I could use he's too, but this one always astounded me. She fell in love with a guy that was homeless and actually had made a place for him in their attic, and he was living in their attic. Now, as crazy as that sounds, this guy, you know, had been in and out of mental health hospitals, all kinds of crazy things, and yet her feelings for him were so strong, it made no difference that he had no future. It made no difference that he was living in her attic. It made all she could think about was how good it felt when she got to interact with him. And I mean, that's how strong that limit reaction is, or thing is. And so you do feel like you can be yourself with no reservations, and that feels incredible. It goes back to the article that I wrote, you know, Everything You Ever Want to Know About Infidelity. You know, our affair partners end up being vanity mirrors. I mean, you look in them, and they make you feel great about yourself. Our mates, on the other hand, have much more of a tendency to make us feel like they're much more like a makeup mirror. They tend to show the flaws, which is why, you know, I always teach that my mate is never my problem. My mate just reveals the problem in me. However, affair partners really don't reveal your issues. Affair partners just make you, in your own mind, look really good and feel really good about yourself. So as crazy as it sounds, those are really difficult situations. And you can know you're completely wrong, and yet the draw of being with that other person just seems so overwhelming. People go ahead and follow the draw. And if they don't, at least make a conscious effort to break off that relationship where they can gain perspective, then in the long run, they've got to break it off long enough to be able to get perspective. Now, eventually they will, especially if they hook up with that person, they'll gain perspective a lot quicker than they want, because like I say, you know, it's always a lot better to want what you don't have than it is to have who you don't want. And once they get into those relationships, that dynamic of wanting what you don't have is gone, and then you do have to face the reality of what the negatives were. Hope that answered that one.
Please tell me she got the guy out of her attic.
Yeah, she did eventually. Boy, was her husband surprised too. That was interesting. Yeah, she got the guy out of the attic, and actually is doing really well. But it took her a while to get over him, as crazy as it sounds. And, you know, even though, and she felt terribly, it was difficult for her breaking off the relationship. And, you know, you would look at it and go, there's nothing there in that relationship. And there's not. But except the feeling that it created for her when she got to talk with him, and that's the problem with limerence. A further post from the same guy says, I don't feel content with my situation at all. I feel trapped. My level of guilt and shame have reached ultimate lows. I'm not seeking validation in this forum. I'm just reaching my point of helplessness. I never imagined I could hurt my wife the way I have. What is making me stay? Emotions, guilt, fear, all of the above? I know this is a trap I've fallen into. I know she will never forgive me. Now, that last statement, I know she'll never forgive me. I'm going to start with that. A lot of times, people use that, I know she'll never forgive me, as a rationalization for not giving the marriage a chance. So by saying, I know they'll never forgive me, therefore, there's no reason that I should even give the relationship a chance because it doesn't have a chance. So that's crazy. And he's right. What's making me stay? I don't know. It's probably more than just emotions, guilt, fear, all the above. I mean, I'd have to talk to him before I could answer that question. But I do know that he has fallen into a trap. But also to think that she could never forgive him, or that they could never have a great relationship, or that they could never move forward from here is crazy. Absolutely, they could go forward, and it wouldn't really be that difficult. Why do so many unfaithful spouses say, I don't remember when asked about the infidelity? Do they really not remember, don't want to remember, or a bit of both? you know, there's a story that I tell about something Stephanie did to me once, which is really pretty funny. She was telling me that I don't understand pillow talk. Actually, she was telling me I didn't understand women. And so I got really defensive, and I said, you know, I do understand women. And so we ended up having this kind of little tiff over whether or not I understood women, which, I mean, it was a stupid argument. I don't know why I was arguing with her about that. But one of the things I finally asked her was, okay, so what don't I understand? And she said, well, one thing you really don't get is pillow talk. And I was like, pillow talk? That's crazy. And I said, okay, why don't you enlighten me? And so she started off with this silly analogy. I thought it was silly, at least. She said, well, like men and women are like two different types of computers, a Mac versus a PC. And I said, yeah. She said, no, you don't. Keep listening. You don't get it yet. She said, the main problem with you guys is you have a very, very limited amount of RAM. And you can only have one application up and running at a time. She said, and I kind of argued. I said, well, that's not true. And she said, well, what did you and Lynn talk about on the phone last night? And I'm sitting there kind of thinking, squinting my eyes, you know, what did Lynn and I talk about? What did we talk about? And after a couple of seconds, she said, see, what you're trying to do right now is you're trying to upload all the data from that application because you closed that application last night. You downloaded it onto some type of removable media. You took it all the way off the machine, and you stuck it in some file cabinet somewhere. You don't have any idea whether or not you talked to Lynn last night. And I kind of was a little sheepish, and I said, but I'll figure it out in a minute. And she said, Do you want to know what Janie and I talked about 2 weeks ago on Thursday night? And I said, not really. And she said, because us women, we have an enormous amount of RAM, and every application is up and running all the time. We always know kind of what's going on and what happened. The difference between the two of us is I don't have any sort of removable media. I can't go, you know, downloading that material and clearing the deck is just up in the RAM running all the time. She said the way women get rid of information is they ultimately have to talk about it. She said pillow talk is the process by which we get to download all of that material so that we can be present with you in the moment, because otherwise stuff is still bouncing around up in our head. She said, have you ever noticed, like, sometimes when we're about to go to sleep at night, I just kind of begin talking about stuff randomly? And I said, oh, yeah, because every time I start drifting off, she starts talking. She said, that's because, you know, there's something I want to talk about, but I know you don't want to talk about it, and I'm not able to clear it out of my head. I can't download it, so I try not to say anything about it. But then I realize I can't go to sleep till I talk about it, so I start talking about it. And it just happens it's the last possible moment I can talk about it. And I said, oh, okay. And she said, have you ever noticed that sometimes, you know, even when we're trying to make love, you know, just when you think things are getting to go, I start talking about random things, you know, like bills and kids. And I said, oh, yeah, I've noticed that one. And I'm always going, focus, girl, focus. And she said, that I can't be present with you in the moment because that stuff is still bouncing around in my head. Well, the story goes on, but what's interesting about it is that I think with men, we really do have the ability to compartmentalize in a way and kind of download it off the machine and put it way the heck away so that we're not thinking about it at all. It's not even hitting the radar. So a lot of times when a guy will say, if they're really in recovery and they're serious about trying to do the rigorous honesty, when they say they don't remember, they really might not have found that stupid disk to upload the data again. I mean, sometimes, now, if they're lying, that's their bad. But if there's a lot of guilt and shame associated with the behavior, there's always the possibility that part of what they've done is to try to compartmentalize and kind of put it way far away and suppress it as their way of avoiding and dealing with the guilt. So, in answer to that question,
court in the morning.
I'm sorry, what?
Besides that, I have a case in court in the morning.
Right.
That's a joke from Barefoot in the Park, the movie. Robert Redford keeps saying, I've got to get a bed. I've got to go to bed. I've got to go to sleep. I've got a case in court in the morning. I've got a case in court in the morning. So that's a little family joke there.
Well, and you know, obviously there are – sometimes we don't remember things because they're really too painful to remember. And so we avoid trying to remember them. Again, not that that is an excuse not to remember. But there really is a radical difference, I think, in the way we process information and in the way we store information. And I'm not trying to make excuse for guys. Maybe somebody's going to call me on the carpet for this. But I think that, you know, typically, not always, men do compartmentalize in a way that makes it a bit more difficult for them to pull up those memories.
But don't men have the ability to remember what's important to them, and that may not be anywhere near what's important to her?
Right. Well, I think we all have the ability to remember what's important to us. But if it wasn't important to us, if we weren't, sometimes, as weird as it sounds, I had a guy that went to jail a few years ago, and for downloading child porn. And one of the things he had done, he was an engineer, and he would, kind of as a way of numbing out, and I've had other guys do things similar to this, he would always on his computer keep one screen open to be able to look at porn while he was doing his drafting, and then he would also have another window open that, you know, was his work that he was being paid ultimately to do. And so it's almost like he really wasn't paying. He almost lived in denial of the other side of him that was doing this behavior. And so I don't even know how deep he was trying to remember the thing. I think he was trying to almost live in denial that he's even doing the thing as he was going through doing the thing. So if someone had said, what did you look at? Because he was also doing engineering stuff all the time at the same time. I don't know that he could clearly tell you. I think that basically he was using the behavior as a way of numbing out. So in that point, like in that example, I'm not sure that he was even fully creating a memory. It was more of an experience he was making as a way of mood altering. So, you know, and the guilt was such, I think he probably was living in denial, not wanting to remember squat. Because it was really hard even in therapy for him to pull up a lot of the stuff that had happened because at one level, part of his defense mechanism was pretending it wasn't even happening while he was doing it.
Right.
As weird as that sounds. I mean, people can get pretty crazy at times.
That's almost schizophrenic, isn't it?
Well, as a recovering addict, haven't you noticed that at times you can be almost schizophrenic or at least split like that?
Yes.
I mean, the addict will do crazy things like that. Working through the pain. Next question. How will I know if I'm working through the pain versus suppressing it? For example, when I get intrusive thoughts, I do what I can to stop thinking about them. Is that suppression? Is it crying when I need to cry and talking about it when I need to talk about it? Is that how I know I'm working through the pain? You know, there was a person I was talking to recently. And even though she was experiencing the pain, she was kind of in the pretend normal, almost pretending that the pain didn't exist, and working really hard just to kind of get on with life, and even moved from the city where they were at as a way of eliminating the majority of the reminders, you know, all kinds of activities like that. And now, she's truly suppressed it, and so when they came in several years later to see me, you know, all of that had come back up to the surface. It had bubbled back up. So with intrusive thoughts, because there's been a lot of confusion about that lately in something I said, so let me see if I can explain it one more time. It really is crying when you need to cry, being willing to feel the feelings when you need to feel the feelings, grieving. It's not about pretending that it's not there. But the problem gets to be sometimes as a way of keeping yourself safe. This is about intrusive thoughts. People just kind of hang on. They won't quit asking questions. They won't quit thinking about it long after they probably felt everything or they've already worked through it and they fully understand everything. It's not even an issue of, I think, feeling the pain. It's an issue of, you know, they've almost become addicted to the intrusive thoughts. I mean, it's like this thing has become such a filter in their mind that every time something occurs, they run it through the affair and the intrusive thoughts, and you know, it's all that. And I can't tell you a timeline. It's not 3 months. It's not 6 months. Somewhere in there, you do get to the place to where you understand it, and you're probably ready to let it go. It's just that it won't let you go. So when I talk about intrusive thoughts, which are really a pain, and maybe a little bit different than grieving, you know, I'm just saying don't let those emotions that are generated by the intrusive thoughts hijack your day. If you're farther down the line, there may be some other things that you need to be thinking about that would be a lot more helpful. The question is, when does that happen? So in answer to that question, it's not suppression to try to stop about intrusive thoughts if you get everything understood. It's not that you're trying to pretend that things didn't happen. You want to be able to look at them clearly, embrace them, see them, not try to deny them, look at the feelings, understand them, cry, all of that, walk through the pain. But then when you get to that point, when that law of diminishing return, you know, kind of comes around, then there's something else you need to do, which is, you know, try to somehow control those thoughts and control those questions. You don't want to always live around this. Like, you know, it was sad for this couple that had come in the other day, and that 4 years later, they're still living around it. You know, they've never moved beyond it. Well, those intrusive thoughts, that's crazy. And nobody's going to be grieving, I don't think, for 4 years. So it's just a matter of they never really moved through it. She suppressed it, and it's still there. They've never worked, I think, understood it, saw it, dealt with it, and so it's still haunting them. So let's see if we've got any more questions for today. So does that help answer your question by any chance? I know you can sit there and at least give me a little chat. And if you have any more questions about that, because I know you don't have a microphone, I would love for you to let me know. We're silent here because I'm waiting to see if she's going to type something on the computer. On the other hand, he or she may be out there feeding kids or, you know, herding cattle or something else and
she's got
not
an
listening.
Answer.
What?
She has an answer on the...
Oh, she does. Oh, you know, it didn't update here. Excuse me. Thank you. Okay. Let me update that. Okay, hang on, it's coming. Ta-da. Okay, I missed the answer. Can you see me the answer one more time? My thing had logged out there. I'm so sorry.
Oh, okay.
If you could type it again, I would appreciate it. Sorry, I only heard part of it. Computer, did you? I love it. You gotta love computers, right? You're sitting there trying to type and I can't see it and your computer shuts down. Well, in answer one more time here, it just seems that well, good. Type those questions while I'm talking here if you've got more questions. The questions are good. You can just put them on the chat here. It'd make it pretty easy. It's just that with the intrusive thoughts, I just said, if you're crying when you need to cry, letting yourself feel the pain, talking when you need to talk, I mean, I think that has a lot to do with the grieving process. You don't want to live in the world, though, of intrusive thoughts. So... okay, so we've got 90 days since disclosure, and he was unfaithful, sexual addiction, and she caught him lying about a small non-affair-related issue and a significant affair-related issue. In both cases, he said he was confused as I called him out about it. So, granted, he's having medication issues. Do you think he could be confused, or is he likely lying? Well, great question, and I would say that, let me read one more time. They're 90 days since disclosure. Husband was unfaithful. Recently caught him lying on a small non-affair-related issue and a significant affair-related issue. In both cases, he said he was confused as she talked to him about it. And she admits he's having medication issues. Do you think he could be confused, or is he likely lying? I probably think that it may be even more gray than that, which probably isn't that helpful. Again, without talking to him, it would be very difficult to make a call on that. But there's even more gray in the middle there. There's a chance that what he's doing is really avoiding intimacy, which would be kind of a form of a lie by omission. I mean, I don't know. If I were in that situation, not saying that if he's having medication issues, I have no idea. But for some people in that situation, the problem is the fear of intimacy, so that when they begin to be transparent, their fear of the loss of relationship is such that they have a great deal of trouble just coming straight out and being transparent and being truthful, just because of the fear of intimacy. And in that moment, if they're flooding emotionally, they won't necessarily get it right the first time. They'll spin it. And then later, after they're able to kind of modulate that anxiety and calm down, they'll come back and try to tell the truth. For some people, if they've lived in an addiction all their life, rigorous honesty is a difficult thing to begin to learn. And in program, or we would call that progress, not perfection. But it's just continuing to pursue the goal of recovery and just moving more and more toward truthfulness. And you know, people have failures and they also have successes. So I don't know. Absolutely great question. I wish I knew the answer to that one. Again, without talking to him, it would be difficult to know. He could be confused. He could just be lying. He could be just learning how to be intimate. And 90 days into the process, if he's working on his recovery and he's working at trying to be honest, I mean, ultimately, that's what you're going to need from him. Hopefully, he'll continue to pursue that and to do that. That probably didn't answer all your question, but is there anything else that I can help with that? Okay, another question. How strongly do you recommend polygraph tests? You know, the whole issue of polygraph tests, and I've used polygraphs before, I use polygraphs for one, two reasons. The one that you're talking about, if I have somebody in treatment and I want them to learn how to be truthful, then as a therapist, I use polygraph tests oftentimes between me and them to work on the whole, truthfulness issue. And sometimes the polygraph is very, very useful with that. Another reason I use polygraphs is if the person just swears and swears they're telling the truth, but their mate doesn't believe them and it's becoming a real issue within the marriage. At that point, I'll use the polygraph as a way to give the hurt spouse kind of a starting line to know what the truth really was. And I find that to be helpful. And the other thing about polygraph tests, unless you're doing the right type of polygraph test, their accuracy, I think, can be very, very skewed. And so it is terribly important that if you ever do use a polygrapher, that you use somebody that I use a protocol, or my polygraphers use a protocol called DogPie. And the DogPie protocol we use simply because it I think it has a much higher accuracy rate. If you want to listen to more information on the polygraph, there's actually in one of the past radio podcasts an interview with a gentleman named Bruce Stevenson. I think it's titled The Use and Abuse of the Polygraph, and it may do a better job of answering some of the particular questions. Do you offer phone counseling through Crossroads? Because of licensure, we cannot offer. You're welcome. Because of that, we can't offer phone counseling through Crossroads or ARC. Now we can do coaching, but in no way is it counseling. If you need a counselor, you need to see a counselor in your area. We have a very different consent form that we use when we're doing work kind of across state lines. If you live in the state of Texas, certainly we can do, because of our licensure, counseling. If you're out of the state of Texas, we can't do counseling. We can talk to you and do some coaching, but certainly that is not counseling, and we would want you to be able to find somebody to help if you need direct counseling in your area. So thanks for asking. And I'm glad you listened to the podcast. I hope it helped you a little bit. Okay, for those of you online, are there any more questions for the day? All is quiet.
I have a question.
Well,
a question, Rick, if you're not getting any of the chat questions or anything. I had a question about, I guess it's a kind of a boundaries question, about, I know I've talked to a couple of people recently about having their spouse leave and then have them come back and, you know, come back rather quickly, you know, just kind of be upset and have the spouse come back without really resolving anything, but setting a boundary, first of all, that if such and such a thing happened, that would be the consequence, and then the person leaving, but then the spouse having them come back right away. And why that doesn't work so well, or, you know, what to do that would be more effective,
well,
I guess, for both people.
You know, I think that one of the problems when people do separations is, as I wrote in the article a while back, separations are very much, to me, our boundaries are very much about self-protection. And the second thing is, if you decide to use a separation as if it feels like that's the only way you're able to stay safe in the relationship is to get some distance. And I do recommend separation sometimes, especially if the interactions have become so negative between a husband and a wife that it's just not safe, and what's happening is their interactions continually are jeopardizing the relationship, are just really hurting the relationship if there's not anything positive happening. I really recommend getting apart, stopping the interaction, and trying to find a point of, sanity. When people separate, in my mind, they need to have a really clear expectation for the separation. What's the purpose of the separation? How long is the separation? What are we going to be doing during the separation? That all needs to be defined, and hopefully that separation is agreed upon by both parties. If you have a separation where one person just kicks the other out and it's for the purpose of just trying to get the other person's attention or letting them know you're serious or something like that, personally, I really wouldn't see that as anything that's very constructive. And if you kick them out and then let them come back, you know, in short order, you know, that probably, I guess in my mind, would say more about the person who called the separation. And they're using the separation, it would feel like, potentially is just kind of a shot across the bow. To let them know that they're serious, that if they don't get their act together, blah, blah, blah. You know, I just recommend that you do something far more structured and intentional before you get to the point of using a separation as a shot across the bow. Again, I don't know if that was, you know, when in the situations you're talking about, Wendy, if those are shot across the bow situations.
Well, I know in one or two of them, it's something that's happened repeatedly. You know, tensions build, and then it's, you know, telling the other person they've got to go, and then the other person goes, and then, you know, maybe within the same day even having them come back. You know, so it's kind of a back and forth kind of thing, not a...
Yeah, all that would say to me is you've got a couple who really just don't know how to deal with issues. You know, like I say, marriages never cause affairs. The affair or the sexual addiction is just the way that other person has chosen to deal with life because they don't know how to deal with the problem in an effective or a healthy way. And using a separation like that really to me just says that the person doesn't have the tools necessary to deal with the problem in probably more constructive ways, and so they end up using the separation again kind of as a, to me, using a separation as a way of getting someone's attention like that is a little bit like trying to take a bolt off using a hammer. Hopefully in our toolbox of life, we've all got lots of tools that we can take out of the toolbox to use in order to deal with particular problems. But if we're void, if we only have like a screwdriver or a hammer in our toolbox, then, you know, we try to live life using that one tool all the time. We're really limited in how we approach problems. And that's what causes a lot of problems for couples, is they just don't have the flexibility or the tools necessary to begin to deal with circumstances. And using a separation that way, to me, is just probably using the wrong tool in the situation. They just need to, they probably need something else, need to learn something else that they don't even know yet what that would be. Okay. With that, I am going to go ahead and end the call for today. So thank you guys for being on and posting your questions. And next week, we're going to talk about sexual addiction. So I will have Erin, when she posts the call, we're just going to be asking questions about sexual addiction. So be getting those ready in your mind and ready to post them. And I'll be talking to you guys next week. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Rick.
Okay,
bye.
Thanks.